This evening we want to pick up again in our C.S. Lewis study on mere Christianity. I said we would begin with questions tonight from last time, but before we do, we'll answer the question from last time. H.C.F. There are two different lines of thought on what C.S. Lewis means in the preface by H. period C. period F. period. There are some who say he's talking about the Holy Catholic faith. However, that is not the case. What he is doing is talking about the highest common factor. Now, why I didn't just say highest common factor, I don't know. But I checked in several different sources. One said he was talking about the Holy Catholic faith, but the way he talks about this in the preface, let me flip over here to that. If we omit the disputed points, we shall have left only a vague and bloodless HCF. The HCF turns out to be something not only positive but pungent, divided from all non-Christian beliefs by a chasm to which the worst divisions inside Christendom are not really comparable at all. Well, if he were talking about the Holy Catholic faith, he would not have talked about that division right there. That was on XI, page 11, in the preface. The HCF, only one person said Holy Catholic faith. The other, every other source with which I consulted said that what Lewis is talking about here is the highest common factor, that is, the most basic points of Christianity. Kind of like sometimes we refer to something as the lowest common denominator. Sometimes I think in some places that's what we're doing with education, is trying to find the lowest common denominator. If you saw the report where we stand worldwide in math and science and all kinds of other things, we have slipped a good bit in the United States. But how many days do we need to be here, Ann? But the highest common factor is what HCF means. He's addressing that those basics of Christianity that separate us from non-Christian religions. And he's talking about the best of those basics, not the lowest of the basics. That kind of thing. So, in answer to your question, TJ, that's what he is talking about there. The highest common factor in Christianity. Are there other questions from last time before we move along in chapters 3 and following? In book 1. I have a handout for book 2, chapters 1 and 2 for later, but this is book 1. Chapter 3 is on the reality of the law. Any questions on what you read there on the reality of the law? Right. He does switch back and forth law of nature to law of human nature. That's right, Jenny. Well, what he's trying to do is distinguish the fact that if we just start looking at the various laws and reality here, there is a law that governs nature. That is, and I like his illustration about the rock. As you know, when you drop a rock, it's going to fall. That's the law of gravity. You don't put the rock out there, let it go, and then the rock says, oh, wait a minute, am I supposed to fall or not? The rock doesn't have a choice. Okay? It doesn't have a choice, and that's the law of nature as applied to stones, trees, or other things. I used to often tell students that if you thought, you know, that God doesn't necessarily get involved in every little bitty action that takes place, personally involved in every little bitty action that takes place on the earth. Sometimes God has built into the system certain laws, including law of gravity, etc., etc., and I would tell you, of course, I'd probably have a heart attack and die if this happened before the car could hit me. But if I waited until a car got right there at 40 miles an hour and then stepped off the curb and expected this big hand to come down and snatch me up out of the way, no, that's not going to happen. Like I said, if it did, I'd probably have a heart attack when it snatched me before the car ever hit me, and I'd, you know, die anyway. But you know, there are certain laws of nature. If I step out in front of that car and that car hits me, there's going to be terrible damage. Maybe fatal damage to me, and I'll probably do some damage to the car. But that's law of nature, something that we don't have a choice or an ability to change if we step in front of that car and it hits us. It's not going to hit us and bounce off. We're going to do the bouncing. That's the law of nature. The law of human nature is something about which we have a choice. As opposed to animals that don't have a choice, they just go by the herd instinct. They live by instinct. It would be nice to think that the cat loves me. But I feed the cat. I give water to the cat. I clean the cat's litter box. And every now and then, I rub the cat. Well, our cat follows you around like a dog. I think it's a mixed breed, interspecies. But I told them not to feed him. So we've got these different laws, and there is a law of nature that applies to certain aspects of the world, but the law of human nature, or decent behavior as he calls it, is something that is different and separates humans from the rest of creation and the created order. Obviously, the rock can't choose to roll down and smash your car. Other factors happen, and when they get to a certain point, the rock's got no choice, and the rock can't hang on with claws and say, no, I'm not going to fall on that one, I'm going to wait for this other one to come. The rock will roll down. That's the law of nature. But decent behavior, what we ought to do, is something that we, as human beings, have the opportunity to choose to do, to make a decision. And as he begins chapter 3, he reiterates two points with which he concluded chapter 1. One of those, that humans were haunted by the idea of a type of behavior that they ought to practice, which he calls morality of the law of human nature. We talked last time, and he talked in the first two chapters, about the fact that if you don't have to say there is a God and have there is a God as your starting point. You can look at certain things that happen in the world, happen in nature, and this whole idea that there are certain laws or accepted ways, modes of behavior that cut across various religious lines, even with folks who seem to have no religion, to see that there has to be something behind all of this. It wasn't random chance that all of this came together and evolved. So there has to be something behind it. And he said that, that's the law of human nature. And then he said the second point is that humans did not and do not practice this behavior that inherently they seem to know is right. In some ways, I guess the law, and I'll probably mention this again, but the law of human nature and knowing that is kind of like our conscience. You can bludgeon your conscience into oblivion after a while if you really want to. But you still know that what you've done is wrong. You just don't care. But that sense of conscience and morality as to what is right and what is wrong, what we should do as opposed to what we do, and we mentioned that about Paul last time, saying the things that I want to do, I don't do, and the things I don't want to do, I end up doing. That whole sense of morality. The law of nature explains what things do, such as gravity and the rock falling, or if the tree snaps, it doesn't still stay upright, or it doesn't fly off, it falls. And the law of decent behavior, it doesn't mean what human beings always do, it tells us what human beings ought to do. And that's really the whole point of ethics. Ethics is what we ought to do. What we ought to do is the basis of ethical behavior. When you study ethics, whether it's Christian ethics or just business ethics or whatever, there are certain things that we know we ought to do that are not necessarily selfish. In fact, if they are selfish, selfishly motivated, then we're not doing what we ought to do. If what we do is selfishly motivated, then we're not doing what we ought to do. In other words, we are breaking that law of human nature. Look up Romans 7:15 in a few moments. Well, I did 15 and following. I didn't know if we were psychotic or psychic or what. No. Or something. So the law of decent behavior or the law of human nature does not mean what we always do, but what we ought to do, and that there is something else that comes before and beyond that in order for us to even understand that there is a sense of behavior of what we ought to do beyond mere facts. Facts tell us how we act. Facts tell us how we act, not how we should act or why we should act that way. Facts are simply, this is how people act. But you know, we really, most of us, want to be in a place that is safe, a place that allows for happiness. And the only way we can do that is if we live in a society, as we said last time at the end, if we live in a society where people play fair, where people live by ethical codes and certain morals. If they don't do that, then it's destructive to society. What we would like to do, or what we're supposed to do, is think what is best to benefit society. Being fair. Being unselfish. But a lot of times we don't like being unselfish, do we? There are times we don't want to be fair, aren't there? And so what Lewis is saying here is the whole fact, or the fact of the matter, that we have that sense of right and wrong, and yeah, I'm selfish, I know I really shouldn't be, but it points to something behind all of this. It's not just random chance. The atoms didn't just suddenly come together to form what would the molecule that would eventually become life and evolve into creatures. That's, I think we said, 1 in 10 to 10 times 10 to 200 power. I've got it written down up in those notes. So there is something beyond that. It goes beyond self-interest. Now, why, Lewis says, you know, we say, well, we do that because it's beneficial to society. But then we don't do it. Some say that there's no mystery in decent behavior because what is good for humans is the byproduct of simple evolution over time. We have simply evolved to become good. But as we said last time, do you have to teach a child to take something that is not theirs? No, you have to teach them not to take something that is not theirs. My example last time, as poor as it may have been, about fishing with my grandfather and my great uncle. And I had a whole stringer full of fish. And Uncle Bob only had a few. But Doc said, when we cleaned them, Doc said, okay, now we got to give Uncle Bob half of them. And I said, but I don't want to. He didn't catch them, I did. Yeah, that whole sense of selfish as opposed to not. Lewis says that really that's kind of a meaningless argument. It's a circular argument to say that decent behavior, which is good for humanity, is simply the byproduct of evolution. Because we do not evolve to that point with the law of human nature. We may evolve in the law of nature and the herd instinct, but not the law of human nature, which causes us to do what is best for the whole as opposed to just selfish. It goes on to say that the law of human nature must be a real thing then. It must be something that actually exists. It's not something that's made up by us because it came along even before we started making laws. That sense of right and wrong and decent behavior or not. Therefore, there has to be something behind it. So what he's doing, what he's actually doing in this first book, over and over and over again, is arguing from a perspective without starting with God as the starting point and then building the evidence to say, see, there's a God behind it. He says, let's go as if we don't know whether there's a God or not. We don't think there's a God or not, or there is or there isn't. And so how could we see that there's got to be something behind all of this other than pure chance? We who are human beings and higher thinkers and all that kind of stuff. And so he's building here a philosophy that is going to lead to theism, there is a God, and then to Christianity as the best expression of God, the most accurate and truthful expression of God. You know, Paul wrestles with what he termed the law of sin. Now, that doesn't mean the law of Moses. A lot of times we Christians tend to think the law, when Paul talks about the law and the law of sin, that we're saying it's the law of Moses. It's not that at all. Paul is talking about this law of sin with which he does battle. Jim, if you would read 15 to 25 from Romans chapter 7.
Excuse me, I do not understand what I am doing because I do not practice what I want to do, but I do what I hate. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree with the law that it is good.
Thank you. So there's that passage again with Paul talking about this law of sin is what he's talking about, and he's saying, you know, it's not Moses' law that's the law of sin. It's this sense of not doing what is right. Doing what I know I should not do is fighting with the law of sin. And so Lewis says there's more than one reality. If there is all of this that goes on and leads us, there has to be more than one reality in the universe. We're not it. We're not the end-all, be-all reality in the universe. There has to be something beyond it, which points to someone beyond our present concept of reality and beyond our own limited behavior. And in order for that one reality to really influence us and to cause us a sense of doubt and in some senses fear, if we break that law of human nature, which we didn't make, which already existed for us, then that one must be real. Not made up, but must be a real being, which then points to God. So what does this say about the universe then, as you move into chapter 4? What lies behind the law? What does it say about the universe? And Lewis, if you read the note at the end of the chapter, Lewis gives three different ideas on the creation of the universe, right? What's the first one? What's the first idea that he gives? The materialist view, which says matter and space have always been here. We've got the Big Bang. We've got Stephen Hawking. We've got all of these others who say, you know, it's always been here. Nobody knows why. Lewis says it's a fluke of nature that how things acted and reacted and evolved. People would say, oh, it's just by random chance that everything happened. There was this spark out there. And of course, I don't know if you saw in the news in the last couple of weeks, some scientists claim that they've seen the birth of another part of the universe out there and planets that look like they may be able to support life and all of this kind of stuff. And some of those scientists are saying, so you see, now, and Stephen Hawking is one of them, by the way, when this came out, and said, now there is no longer any need to think that there was a God or a being behind that spark in the Big Bang because it's random chance. If it's random, if we're all random, how does that make you feel? What's that say about what we do and who we are? I mean, don't even think about heaven. Yeah, it's pretty worthless. Why do anything other than what we just feel like doing at the moment? I mean, it seems pretty worthless, right? If we're all just ranting, I know before somebody says it, I sometimes, every now and then, it's rare, I know, but every now and then I have a random thought that just kind of pops it. No. Yeah. And we'd need a shovel if I kept talking about that, right? But the materialist view, he says, is that which says it's just all random. And we really don't have a purpose other than we're here, we live, we die, and that's it. Which even, I mean, I think Hinduism is one of the most pessimistic religions out there. Even the Hindus don't want to just, I mean, eventually they want to die and not show up again. But they want to try and live a good life before they die and not show up again. And in Hinduism, the belief is that you go through thousands of reincarnations before you finally get it right. And if you're one of the untouchables, you got a caste system, which I know Gandhi outlawed it officially, but it still operates. And you got four castes, but below that are what are the untouchables, the severely diseased and homeless and poor and all that kind of stuff. And according to Hindu philosophy and religion, if you're once born an untouchable, always an untouchable. When you're born again, you'll always be born an untouchable until there is nothing left of time or matter. That's pretty pessimistic. That's kind of like, okay, it's random, right? The second view he puts forth is the religious view, right? That there is a mind behind the universe that is conscious, has a purpose, prefers one thing over another, and produce creatures with minds like his or its, he would say its at this point, in order to think. Seems to me Jesus said something about loving God with a heart, soul, mind, and strength. If you go to the Hebrew Scriptures, and if you go to Judaism as it developed, and even a Judaistic view of the Bible, the Old Testament, never is the question of the existence of God raised. It's always, what is God like, what does God expect of me, and where can I find God? And within Judaism and Christianity, the Bible is a document that introduces us to the one true God, who is personal, who has a purpose in history, who acts within the confines of history, and who seeks to have relationship with people. Well, guess what? Lewis says here that that mind behind the universe is conscious, has a purpose, prefers one thing to another, and produce creatures with minds like it so they could think and relate to it. Seems to me the early Jews had it a whole lot sooner than Lewis, but that's the same thing. That sense that there is something beyond just mere chance. And it is that mind. That's the religionist view. Of course, at the end of the chapter, he gives a third position that is there, and that is the life force view. The life force or creative evolution. I'm not talking about creationism here. I'm talking about 1942. Creative evolution. That there is a life force out there that started creating and then allowed evolution to occur, but not random evolution or one life form to another. It was purposeful evolution guided by a life force. And, you know, evolution, the word evolution simply means change, and we're still evolving. I mean, if you want to think about it, people today tend to be, most anyway, tend to be taller than people were 10, 20, 50 years ago, or 100 years ago, right? That's change. That's evolving. We're not talking about jumping from one species to another. We're not talking about a single-cell microorganism suddenly jumping and becoming a dog. Skipping all those other... I'm talking about DOG, not DAWG. But, you know, you've got this life force that had a purpose in creating, and that as we change and as different life forms occurred, this life force, which has a mind, brought life and guides it toward perfection. And Lewis says, if that is the case, if there is a mind behind this, if this life force behind it has a mind, then it functions as a what? Starts with a G, ends with a D, has an O in the middle. As a God. It functions as a God. Really and truly. If not, then Why say something without a mind has any purpose at all? But he also says we have to be careful about the life force view of creation of the universe, because it may give emotional comfort of believing with none of the unpleasant side effects. If it's simply a life force behind it that guides it and has a purpose, you've got what he calls a tame God. A tame God. I like his line, all of the thrill and none of the cost. All of the thrill and none of the cost of the religion. Life's good, thanks be to God. Take me along, I'm ready to go. I want to be bad, though. I want to do something bad. I don't want to always do good. Well, if it's a life force that's just behind it, has a purpose in creating and evolving, but is not involved in the law of human nature, go ahead and do what you want because it doesn't care. It's almost like the watchmaker God or the clockmaker God of the Enlightenment period, where God created this part of the universe, wound it up like a clock. It's now unwinding, and God got bored and went off after watching a while, went off somewhere and started making something else to wind up and let it go. You know, so God's got this, the universe is just this room with all these different clocks in it. Or the whole sense of an agnostic. Most folks who are simply theists or deists are really kind of on the agnostic fringe, and that means, okay, there is a God, but agnosis, no knowledge. You can't really have knowledge of God. God really doesn't want to know you, so therefore you just kind of go along and do whatever you want to. And if something good happens, that's great. If you do something bad, well, God doesn't care. God's off doing something else, and God doesn't get involved with all that kind of stuff. So Lewis warns that one can find comfort in that sense of the life force creativity. But most of the time when we talk about the life force creativity, then what we do is we create a God that is limited in power and really doesn't care and goes off somewhere else, and it doesn't matter what we do other than be selfish. So it really goes, that really goes against the law of human nature. Because the law of human nature, if there is a God behind it who really cares and has a purpose, then the law of human nature says it does make a difference. It does matter. It matters to God. It matters to you. It matters to me. It matters to others around. Now, why does Lewis, anyone remember, why does Lewis say that science can't really prove all of that? Why science can't show us God, can't go beyond certain things? What's the role of science? How does science operate? Experiment. Yes, Jerry, experiment. It operates through experiments and watching how things act, but it can't explain why something is there at all. And it can't explain why or what is behind it and why it necessarily always acts in a certain way. And especially when there's an aberration. You know, people think science is all about definite. No, there are always aberrations in scientific experiments. So even if it's that one out of 150,000, it's that one aberration. As I often remind folks, whether they're in the hospital or somewhere else, but especially in the hospital and talking about the doctor, I said, got to remember what to do and still call practice. They're still practicing, trying to get it right. Science can only can lead us a great distance, but only so far. And Lewis says that science cannot answer every question, because when science gets down to it, even with this latest report that Hawking says, oh, we don't need God behind this because we can watch what's unfolding out there. Of course, it's so many light years away that, you know. But, okay, then what's the purpose of it all? Why is it here? What's the purpose? Why is it unfolding the way that it is? Science cannot answer any of those questions. There's only one place to look. And since we are humans, he says, in order to begin to understand more, we need to look at ourselves and see why there is an influence of moral law which we didn't make, we can't forget, and know we should obey. We didn't make the law originally. We can't forget it. because somehow it keeps showing up. I mean, people, you know, people can be doing, and you can be all by yourself and doing something, and you make a mistake, and what do? Wonder if there's anybody around watching. Yeah, David, King David, and there were a few people knew, not a whole lot, but a lot of folks. But King David had a fling with Bathsheba, and then had her husband killed. I mean, had him murdered. That's pretty cold. Sent the death order with Uriah the Hittite to the front lines because he knew he wouldn't open it up to have him killed because his other plans didn't work. And David thought he was off the hook, scot-free. But David forgot just one minor character in it all. David should have gone. God knew. And David was reminded of that. But, I mean, really, if you're doing something, and you're dealing with the blinds at home, and you turn that little stick right there too far, and it snaps, and then it won't work, and you try to get it to work, and it won't, now you got to figure out, okay, it's broken, I really don't want to replace it right now. Can I blame it on the cat? Yeah. Because we know there's certain, you know, somebody's going to be upset. Can I blame it on the cat? So this whole thing of, you know, moral law, we can't get away from it. We know when we do something wrong, whether it's something that we see as minor or something that's major, there's this little nagging conscience or whatever within us that says you've done wrong. Well, science can't show us that. The moral law helps us to understand there is a power behind what makes things as they are. There is a moral power behind that. That moral power then is or shows itself within us as an influence, that conscience trying to get us to behave a certain way. And Lewis argues then, because of its effect and because of the fact that we didn't make it, but we can't get away from it, and we know that it's wrong, even if we still do it and try and hide it, shows that there is that mind, that power, which eventually we come to know as God. So what Lewis has done in these first few chapters in this first book has started with, we're going to say, we don't know if there's a God or not. But let's start looking at this moral law, this law of human nature, as opposed to other laws. And why do we feel that way? Why are we guided by it? Why does it bother us to break it? Ooh, guess what? That leads us to the understanding there has to be something or someone behind it that gave us the moral law, the sense of conscience, etc. And we do not exist solely on our own, but we are under the influence of that guide to behave in certain ways. We're told that we should obey, but unlike the rock or the tree, we have a choice to obey or not. He gives that example of the letter packet that the mail person goes around. You don't have the right to pick up every one of them and look, but you get one that's addressed to you, man, and then you look and it's myself. What do? You find inside that which forces you to face the question of making choices, and where do those choices come from? Who influences those? But, he says, we have cause to be uneasy about that, chapter 5. And he gives us three reasons why Christianity makes sense in light of moral law or the law of human nature. Reason number one, he says, is that Christians or that humans are on the wrong road. Do you agree we're on the wrong road, or do you think we're on the right road? Human beings as a whole. Okay, we are killing the planet. Killing the planet, we're killing each other. In all kinds of ways. I'm not going to rug out and hug every tree. Last time I hugged a tree was when the tree stand slipped and I had to grab it real quick just to make sure that it was steady. But I understand what you're saying. We are killing the planet. And it's taken us a long time to figure out what to do about it, and we still don't agree on what to do about it. But, you know, he says humanity's on the wrong road. And the only way to make progress when we're on the wrong road is to do what? Progress means to get nearer to where you want to be. So what does he say? If we're on the wrong road, what's the only way to make progress? Yeah, that's right. You're going down the wrong road. The only way to make progress is to turn around and go back. Get on the right road, and then journey along. That almost sounds like something biblical, doesn't it? Jeremiah and his concept of shub, to repent, that is to come all the way back to the beginning. And we've used before in talking about that in the sanctuary, talk about making a trip from here up to the McDonald's, the truck stop at the McDonald's, and we all leave here and we get down the road a little ways and we see something on the side of the road right before we get to the bridge, something's going on at the fire department, we pull in, we check it out, now everything's okay, now we're going to go back on our journey. But instead of getting back out and going straight on to McDonald's or the truck stop, well, with all the grease, probably one and the same. But in order to really operate by this whole idea of coming back shub, we would turn right out of the parking lot, come back to this parking lot, turn around, start again. This time we get over and we notice that something's going on at Hazel's house. And so we all turn there at the clock and go to Hazel's house. And then after a while we leave Hazel's house. Well, guess what? We hadn't ended that journey yet. We hadn't gotten there yet. But what we do is we come all the way back here, start again, until we make the journey without getting sidetracked. That's what he's talking about here. In order to make progress, we're on the wrong road. We need to figure out where we need to make the U-turn, go back, and start all over again until we can get to that end. Being guided. We must admit our mistakes in order to be progressive, whether it flows around or not. Those commercials drive me crazy. Progressive auto insurance with flow.
Don't let you over there say it.
Yep, that's one of those yogiisms. If you come to a fork in the road, take it. Of course, when I think about forks in the road, I think about the Muppet movie when Kermit's reading the map and they're driving along and says, take the fork in the road. He said, what fork? He said, and there's this big fork right there in the middle of the road. That one. We do have cause to be uneasy. Why? Because we spend so much time on the wrong road. Well, how do we know we spend time on the wrong road? If there's not some mind or something or someone behind the law of human nature, we wouldn't know we were on the wrong road, right? So Lewis is building a case even more here toward the fact that the very fact that we know we are on the wrong road and we find ourselves on the wrong road and know that we've got to do something to escape the wrong road says there has to be a mind behind it, there has to be God. And this is where he moves to theism. There has to be a somebody, and he gives two bits of evidence about that. First of all, the universe that the somebody has made. He says, he's a great artist, but he is also merciless if that's all there is. I mean, is nature not cruel? Do we not say nature is cruel a lot of times? Watch how nature treats animals, etc. And you think chronic wasting disease is a bad thing, which is the same thing as mad cow disease, only it's in wild animals like elk and deer. I read an article the other day that epizootic hemorrhagic disease is now more devastating than CWD. Y'all probably don't want to know this, but this is nature is cruel. epizootic hemorrhagic disease is also known as blue tongue. And what happens, some of the little mites and midges carry a certain bacteria and they bite, and if it gets into the bloodstream at a certain point in the deer, it can be a healthy deer. But if the immune system's off or something, they get enough of those bites, their tongue will swell up, they will run a high fever, and they will die right beside of a stream, not able to drink the water. Nature's cruel. And if all we have is that whole sense of there's somebody that made it but then ran off, that's pretty cruel. But the second bit of evidence that we have that there's a somebody is that moral law that helps us find out about God, who is interested in right and moral conduct. But God's not a softy. And it's time, and we will pick up there next time, finishing up chapter 5 in book 1. We'll start with questions again. Also, I have a handout here, and it's kind of, you can do this and then flip it over and it's right side, but if you do this and flip it like this, you're going to have to stand on your head to read the other side. Because it's upside down. But I do want to start with questions next time. In chapter 5, we have cause to be uneasy, but it's also in chapter 5 where Lewis comes down and says the Christian religion, he is finally convinced that the Christian religion is the way, the best way to understand God and these concepts of God. But then, starting in book 2, Lewis begins talking about the rival concepts of God, that there are different ideas about God, and this is also in chapter 1 where he talks about his own atheism, the arguments he used in atheism that didn't work, and his move from being from realizing that as an atheist he actually had less evidence to stand on, and his arguments made less sense than those that he was trying to disprove. And so I thank you all for being here. I know Lewis can be tough, but starting in book 2, he gets easier to understand. And if you have questions you want to talk about afterwards, we can do that. But we'll start with questions next time. Thank you. God bless you. Go in peace.